So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello and welcome to Geekily Yoked, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
Literally now.
That's very true.
I am a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
And now that we're six-week parents, we're able to provide you all with expert parenting advice, so this is going to be less geek and more about how to get your child at sleep at night, and how to make sure feeding is right, because, you see, we've had 6 weeks of experience, so now we're pretty much the best at it, and we're able to judge you, and any failures we've had weren't failures, they were just little experiments, little bumps along the way, and so...
We haven't had any failures, I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. Which makes me a giant nerd.
Rachel,
how have you been?
I don't know. Am I a human being?
You seem slightly more human than when we tried this 2 weeks ago.
It's true. I think we're moving in a somewhat progressive direction.
We are out of your, like, ensconced chair throne.
I am not sitting in the armchair that I spend roughly 10 to 12 hours a day sitting in, as she alternatively feeds and sleeps on me.
Well, that is what she does. I'm back at work, which is, making some interesting... scheduling issues, but for the most part, we seem to be trying to return.
Yes.
To some state of normalcy.
Indeed.
Have you discovered anything fun and exciting sitting in your chair for 10 to 12 hours?
I watched the second season of Once Upon a Time on Netflix.
Yeah.
For reasons that escape me, because I'm like, this is not a good show.
But
I think it's sort of like when your mom talked about how she really got into soap operas.
Oh, right.
When she spent like that random year.
I think, yeah.
As like a stay-at-home mom.
Precisely.
And she talks about how like she really got into soap operas and understands how people...
And get into them.
So, yeah.
So Once Upon a Time is now one of your stories, I take it?
I don't care that. Like, I have found a couple episodes from the third season still available for streaming online.
Because there are, like, countless television shows on Netflix that you could choose from.
Yeah. But this is one that I had watched enough of it that I was idly curious to see what was going on with it.
Okay.
And, like...
Was it worth it?
I don't know.
Did you get to learn more about Rumpelstiltskin?
See, he's the only interesting character.
Yep.
Captain Hook isn't bad.
No.
But I feel like they do, like, Rumpelstiltskin achieves what they try to achieve with the Evil Queen character.
Oh, being this sort of compelling...
Yeah, that, villain. Like, that his villainy comes out of his pain.
Yeah.
And even as he does villainous things, you empathize with him because he's clearly in so much pain as he's acting them out, and he doesn't want to be this dark person. It's just, like, fate... and destiny conspire to make him this terrible person, and he obviously horrible decisions that he makes.
Well, yes.
I mean, he could, but he has things that he loves that he cuts off from himself by his own actions and choices, right?
Yeah.
And it's very compelling, and you actually feel for him. And I feel
like, goals,
yeah,
right?
And I feel like it's exactly the same thing they want to do with the Evil Queen character.
Regina,
yes. But either the actress just can't pull it off, or like just the stakes that they give her are dumb,
yeah.
So...
See, Amanda doesn't like all this.
Amanda, yes, Amanda's like, why are you making me watch this? I liked it when we watched Babylon 5.
She did like that one.
And Daddy can't watch Star Trek with me anymore because they took it off Netflix.
That is so true and so depressing. I even had like a whole little like Facebook thing dedicated to teaching her about Star Trek, and now I'm gonna like have to start watching the movies, or else, you know what, I'm just gonna watch whatever sci-fi I want.
And just keep it under the same title?
I just explain it to her. I feel like Star Trek can sort of act as a shorthand for these things. I was already making like Babylon 5.
As I was watching Babylon 5.
Talking about how I totally wanted to get Centauri hair.
Man, and that brings us into our topic for today.
It's true.
Because I rewatched the vast majority of Babylon 5, which I don't know if it's sadder that I rewatched it like a matter of months after watching it for the first time.
Well, that's what was confusing me. The fact that like you'd sort of known about this show, but only really recently gotten into it, and then it's like, well, Time to watch it over again. Well, except you know what? Like season what, 1 and 2.
Well, I didn't really watch. Yeah, I didn't watch season 1 again because I just don't like Sinclair enough.
Know what Sinclair's gonna do?
Yeah, I thought about going back and rewatching the very first episode.
Okay.
Just out of curiosity.
Do we have the like little opening miniseries?
No, but I've heard it's so bad.
We had it like one of the like.
Crabtree loaned it to me, okay. And I never got around to watching it.
Okay, well, that's fair. No, it's not great. But I figured since you're already like watching all these,
yeah, things, it's true.
No, the things you really need to stay away from are the awful miniseries that came afterwards.
Oh right, yeah.
Where like by that point they would get like one or two characters from the main cast, like Lando would show up, or if there's Jakar.
Yeah.
But the worst thing was I remember watching was like Ranger Ship or something.
Oh, just all the stories of the Rangers?
I don't know. But there was just... What I really took away from it was that they had these... Their battleships that they would go into to fight. But the way they would like use the weapons is like a girl would go into the weapons area, which was like the holodeck. And suddenly like the walls would turn into like the stars and she would be the ship. And she would do like punches and kicks. And the punches and kicks determined where the laser fire went to. So it was like she was having a weird karate match with the other ships, but they weren't having karate matches. They were just ships shooting at them. So it was dumb. It's like, this seems inefficient. I don't understand how your punches mean, like, torpedoes.
Yeah, I think I was just sort of... I just watched it, and I just wanted to kind of see how the story actually built on itself. Okay. Like, you know, watching Londo's sort of fall and... Whether it's fall and redemption or just continuous fall...
It is Londo.
Is a debate one could have. But just seeing how that's built divots. Up... Yeah, exactly. Seeing how that's played out, watching Jakar's character...
Yeah.
I mean, well, that's really what I'm in Babylon 5 for.
All right, so this theme is you sitting around watching sci-fi you've just watched 5 minutes.
Well, no, but the idea of rewatching things.
Okay.
And what are the things that we enjoy rewatching? Why we enjoy rewatching things? What things stand up to rewatching or rereading, re-experiencing?
Well, and when you suggested this to me, you mentioned a specific quote.
Well, this is our back at when we were in undergrad. And hanging out amongst many of our geeky acquaintances, someone came up with the idea that the definition of a geek as being someone who enjoys like hearing the same stories or reading the same books over and over again, and like it never lessens in enjoyment.
Yeah, precisely. Like a geek is perfectly happy to watch the same Star Trek episode over and over and over again, and there's no like diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Whereas presumably,
or there might even be increasing returns.
Well, yes,
precisely. As you like sort of pick up on nuances. This is an interesting parallel to the documentary you watched last night.
Yes.
That I was just the documentary on like people watching The Shining.
Yeah. So last night I watched Room 237, which, as Rachel pointed out, is a documentary about people who have watched The Shining and have come up with really sort of obsessive theories. And they range from, like, kind of generic, like, you know, sort of vague discussions about how, oh, Kubrick is trying to say this really important thing about humanity, to very specific, no, this is a movie obviously about the Holocaust, this is a movie about the American genocide of the Indians, this is a movie about Stanley Kubrick confessing to faking the footage from the moon landing. That particular guy was my favorite. Not because he was saying we didn't go to the moon, but the footage of us going to the moon was faked.
Right.
For reasons. But, and essentially it's they would find a continuity error and say, well, this obviously can't be a continuity error.
Because Kubrick is too amazing for that.
Too amazing. And he, you know, will take this into account. So what does it mean that in this panel, you can see on the little boy's room a sticker of the seventh dwarf Dopey, but then in this shot later, that sticker is missing. What does that mean? And like, you can find, you know, these cans of this specific brand of like, oh, what was it? It was like baking powder, but it was like it had like a picture of a Native American on it. So it's like, you know, some Indian brand kind of thing. And that like was representing, you know, that's what clued this guy in. I saw this specific brand, just a can just sitting there. And suddenly I knew that this movie was about X, Y, and Z. So,
I think you mean X, Y, and Z. We are in Canada.
Oh, excuse me. Sorry. The Mounties will come showing up.
You're going to learn the unrhyming ABC song. It drives me crazy.
Not in this house, though.
I'm sitting in my office in the church, and the children come by, and they're singing, "Now I know my ABCs." Oh, sorry. I'm singing the song out of order.
Oh, yes. Yes, you are.
Yes. So,
T-U-V-W-X-Y-N-Z.
Yes, exactly. And it just doesn't rhyme. And it drives me absolutely crazy.
It's very strange. She's also going to have a bit of unfortunate quality of my speaking pattern. We'll see where she can't distinguish between safety pins and writing pins.
Ah, yes.
That's the one that crops up at work the most. I'll ask for a pen and people will be like, a what? I'll be like, you know, like a pen, an ink pen. They're like, oh, a pen. And my Tennesseeness just...
Well, it's like the... At our old parish where I kept getting made fun of for apparently, allegedly saying gad all the time.
Gad?
That when I was praying the colleagues would be like, Almighty God, and I was accused of saying gad.
As opposed to gold?
Yes. Well, this was St. Thomas's.
Stuffiness was...
Well, it was just very, very Englishly influenced.
Yeah. So you know what, she's gonna pick up all sorts of terrible things. We don't know what Canadian television is gonna do to her brain.
It's true.
That is where you pick up your accent.
It's true. So that is our huge digression from, hopefully we are not watching things repeatedly and obsessively as the people in the documentary you were watching.
Although I did like your theory that people in
all English majors need to watch this at some point.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, because you know it's interesting without out of context and with the sort of the vehemence of which they're speaking, their theories sound kind of plausible.
Yeah.
Because they're sort of said with enough conviction, but then you sit back and you're like, wait, no, that doesn't make any sense.
Okay. So taking out of consideration the fact that maybe rewatching things and the joy of rewatching and re-experiencing something is not as obsessive as these people with The Shining.
Yes.
What is it that maybe we should start with the things that we have really enjoyed rewatching or watching multiple times or reading multiple times.
Sure.
And then go into like why it is that we do this.
Well, I'm going to start with a bit of a caveat, which is that I grew up in West Africa, and so I didn't actually have access to like TV. What I did have access to were video cassettes, and specifically a lot of VHS tapes of television that had been recorded in the States. And then we were watching there in Nigeria. What this means is that there are a lot of TV shows, and specifically there are a lot of episodes of TV shows that I have seen over and over and over again. I don't know if that quite fits the theme, but I was really more of a captive audience in those situations. So I'm going to try to parse my memories for things that like I actually had the wherewithal and will to keep watching. And the one I want to come to is Arrested Development.
Hmm.
Arrested Development.
Yes.
Not only did I just watch it a bunch, you know, when we first discovered it, but, you know, I got the DVDs and I just showed it to everyone.
You were quite the proselytizer.
And I did, you know, and I
that and The British Office.
Well, that was going to be the next one I got to, was The British Office.
But I know so well.
With The British Office, that's when I had the most success showing it to people. And this kind of touches on our evangelism.
Right.
Because there's watching something over and over again because you're showing it to multiple people.
And then there's, the re-watching something when you're watching it with people who haven't seen it before and you're sort of getting to re-experiencing it through them.
Yes, precisely.
Is really a whole different thing.
But I know Arrested Development falls out of that category because we had the DVDs of them. And I'd seen them like tons and tons of time. And yet there was like a period of a few months when my schedule at work was such that when I came home, I would like sit down and I would watch I would watch The Simpsons, and then immediately after that would be Arrested Development.
Just
syndicated episodes, which I have on DVD, which I could watch at any time.
Yeah.
But I would just sort of like be sitting there and be like,
there's something delightful about finding something you like just on TV and watching it.
Well, yes, that feeling of like, oh, I'm watching this with other people, and it's such a good show that I can just watch it. Like, every time I sit down to kind of rewatch it again, I think like, okay, what are the weak episodes? And for some reason, my mind always thinks that Breaking Up Buster is a weak episode.
Which one is that?
That's the one where like Michael has to take care of Buster for a day, and Buster keeps sort of yawning through various meetings. But it's also the episode that has Dead Pigeon Do Not Eat.
Oh, like I cannot think of a bad episode of Arrested Development.
No, not until maybe the new season. Although we did like it, but
I appreciated what it was. I think you just had to respect that
it was something different.
They were doing something different. It's of a different era, and I can. Spoilers for anyone who hasn't seen season 4 of Arrested Development for the next 30 seconds. I can give it a lot of slack for it ending with George Michael punching Michael in the face.
That was pretty amazing.
Like, that just was such a comeuppance that has been waiting.
No, and it really was sort of one giant story.
Yeah.
It really was this sort of giant puzzle story as opposed to regular, you know, the first three seasons of Arrested Development, which had a slightly more sitcom-y kind of vibe to them, even if it was this interesting, like, it was a different kind of puzzle. Like, it was this sort of, you know, long-form story.
I would say season 4 of Arrested Development was like... experimental project, given that it was all available at one time.
Yes, precisely.
I think it was an interesting use of a new medium.
The British office was its own other sort of kettle of fish, you know, in that I discovered it while flying to England in the first place, which is weird.
Okay.
And it's interesting, you know, these things that you discover on your own versus discovering by people, like, sharing with you. But I remember watching it, you know, on television, and then, like, getting the DVDs and being super, super obsessed with them. And, again, showing them to friends. And I think, but even with The Office, I would sit down and just, like, watch episodes here and there.
Yeah.
And, again, like with the rest of the development, like, you know, it's hard to find a bad
episode. Well, and there are scenes in that just never, ever, ever get old for me. The Training Day episode.
Oh, gosh darn.
When they cut away, they talk about, David Brent is talking about how wants to be a singer-songwriter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they cut away to the next scene where he's sitting there playing Free Love on the Free Love freeway. And Tim just looks at the camera and he went home to get it. And walks away. And that is my favorite line in the entire Office.
No, it's just...
And I could just watch that scene over and over and over again.
And it just... I mean, that was something I loved because I felt a sense of ownership with The Office. You know, it was one of those things that I discovered and I shared with a couple of different folks. But, you know, for the most part, it, you know, it was something that felt like, you know, something that I loved. And, you know, it felt like a part of me I could sort of keep going back to again and again and again and again. A show that I felt a strange urge to kind of rewatch because we have all the DVDs for it was Scrubs, which I sort of, like, you know, tried to share with folks and, you know, would watch here and there. But then I just listened to the Colin Hay soundtrack, and I think that kind of covered my urge to watch Scrubs.
So listen to enough Colin Hay and you've effectively watched the first three seasons of Scrubs?
That's the experience, you know, sort of, yeah. You know, in about an hour, so.
It's true. But Scrubs is another show that I think you can really enjoy.
Well, it was episodic enough.
Yeah.
And had enough of kind of, like, you know, sort of through line. I mean, there was sort of...
Although I will admit I did eventually get tired of that Brendan Fraser episode that, like, just seemed to be the episode of Scrubs that...
Oh, that kept... Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't watch it too many times to get sort of frustrated with it. But no, I definitely know what you're talking
about. It was definitely the first episode of Scrubs I ever saw.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
I think Tom showed it to me.
Gotcha.
When we were at Kenyon.
I think I may have accidentally caught the very first episode on a break from Blockbuster on actual TV in, like, a Subway or a Mr. Blues or something like that. But it wasn't until undergrad when I think we were watching them via very legal means to catch up that I really sort of got yeah. super into it.
Anything else? Movies? Books?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot. Movie-wise, I realized this probably works out more because there are a few movies that I can watch over and over and over again. I mean, there's some that I had to because I lived in West Africa, and so for, you know, reasons beyond compare, I was watching Name of the Rose more times than a child should have, and, like, Chorus Line more times than anyone should. But... Once I got back to the States, I found that the two movies I would return to again and again, especially if I were in a kind of, like, a bad mood or sick or just, like, you know, needed a familiar feeling, were Crimson Tide and Air Force One.
Yeah, you did have a weird, like, thing about Air Force One for a long time.
I would watch Air Force One over and over and over again, and there were, like, each time it was just like watching it for the first time, you know, like...
It's kind of interesting for a suspense movie.
Well, yeah, but it's a suspense movie where you know everything's going to work out fine, right? I mean, I guess Crimson Tide, there's more tension to it because it's a slightly more nuanced film. But really, I think that's just I like submarines.
Yeah.
I just like all the interplay with all the folks in Crimson Tide. But yeah, those are two movies where if I was just in a kind of like a meh mood, I could just put in and know that I was sort of fine. And they're not stellar movies by any means. But they were sort of these, and then I got into my head that they were my go-to movies.
Yeah.
And then that sort of made them my go-to movies in a bizarre kind of recursive way.
My go-to movies for a long time were George of the Jungle.
Yes.
I can watch that movie anytime, and I love it so much. I'm not proud.
Okay.
When Harry Met Sally.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Like and Enchanted.
When Enchanted is in the DVD player, I know that you're in a mood.
Speaking of things in a mood, should I deal with our crying child? Oh. We have two. We have two noise-making creatures now.
Well, she just—we discovered that Amanda really wants to talk. That like she's very, you know, she's very eager to participate in the podcast and in conversations in general. So we figured that this squealing and this whining is just a part of that. Now, Rachel, aside from the sort of, you know, your standard sci-fi fare, like, are there sort of, like, do you find that you watch your favorite movies over and over again? Or is it like me, do you find, like, a sort of set group of mediocre ones and kind of keep going back to them?
Well, I think it's like, sometimes the best movies aren't necessarily the ones you want to, at least if you're me,
yeah,
aren't the ones that necessarily want to watch over and over again.
Yeah.
Like, weirdly, I don't really have a strong desire to watch the Lord of the Rings movies over. Well, I mean, part of this, there's just such an investment, yeah, right? But I mean, it's The Princess Bride Stardust.
Yeah.
I have watched that movie so many times, and I just, it's fun. It just makes me feel happy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very different. I know a lot of people who didn't like it. It is very different than the book in some ways.
Oh, yeah.
But I enjoy it. It has that same, it just has a sense of adventure and...
Yeah, well, I guess the other part of that is then, like, with these movies, are we sort of actively rewatching them to sort of see what's, like, what we missed? Or, like, or are these movies that we sort of casually put on while we're doing other things?
I don't do very well with things on casually while I'm doing other things.
Yeah.
I do like... I mean, there is a piece of me that is obsessively watching these things. Like, I will watch the BBC Pride and Prejudice to catch every nuance of every look between Lizzie and Darcy because I'm a big dumb girl.
Wow. Yeah, that's the exact opposite of me. Like, if I'm watching something I've seen before...
Well, you're much better at, like, multitasking and doing things while...
Much better, or I just don't care.
No, but I mean, I really can't... I find it very difficult to do other things while watching something because I really am rewatching for...
Except sleep.
Well, yes, I definitely fall asleep.
Which is something that I have trouble doing.
Which is why it drives you crazy. The Gilmore Girls, yeah, right? The Gilmore Girls is an example of something that there are episodes of the Gilmore Girls that I don't even want to count how many times I've seen them, but that is something that falls in the category of... Oh, little one. I'm sorry. Yes, Rory is very annoying sometimes.
Oh, it's so true. And what has Emily done this time?
It's such an inoffensive show that I like. It's the thing I put
in. Anything from you.
Yeah, so I put it in when I want to go to sleep, and then it drives you crazy because
then I can't sleep.
You can't sleep. I apologize.
And this, I feel like our household may be more prone to this because we just don't watch TV.
Yeah.
In the same way, right? I feel like whereas other places, other households might just like turn on the TV and just sort of mindlessly have it on, or like
whereas we'll mindlessly have on stuff that we've seen.
Yeah, or we'll go to Netflix and we'll sort of see kind of what's there and then work our way through that.
Now we've looked a lot at the stuff that we watch, and we've kind of discussed a little bit about why we rewatch this stuff. You know, whether it's kind of to go back and sort of see what we've missed. One thing I was thinking about, you know, that I always think that I'm going to do, but I don't ever, is go back to watch all the audio commentaries on TV shows.
Oh, yeah. I watch a lot of, when I cook, I listen to audio commentaries when I cook.
That's right. Because I remember I tried doing that with Scrubs and being kind of like, nope. I think I did it with all of Arrested Development, finally. And I definitely remember doing it for the Family Guy.
Really?
Because that was amazing. Just the cast just being terrible, and full of swears and swearing in character. So that was kind of amazing. The Arrested Development audio commentary was pretty fun because after a while they sort of like prank phone calling each other.
Really?
I think at one point they like were trying to mess around with the guy who played the dad. Oh, why is his name?
Tambor?
Yeah, they were like trying to call him up. He was like, "Who is this?" It's like, "This is Will Arnett." I don't do that with, I mean, we have so many, but I don't really, when I do rewatch that for the most part, I'm not rewatching it for that, those sort of purposes. Like, so why do you feel compelled to rewatch things aside from the fact that it's in the DVD player or it's on Netflix? And
well, I think part of it is the story changes on a rewatching, right?
Oh, yeah?
Like, it's Farscape.
Okay.
Is a great example, right? So I'm rewatching Farscape now because I'm on mat leave and stuck in a chair for 10 hours a day.
Yes.
With a baby. So I was like, I will rewatch Farscape from beginning to end because I'm obsessive.
Including the really awful first season episodes.
Including the episode I just watched, which is my least favorite episode.
The one where they're like in the weird like suicide cult, or they're jumping off cliffs, and then they give bad hair.
And I'm like, I am committed to this project. But it's for me, Farscape is a different story on a rewatch than the first time through. Because the first time through, especially in those really, really lame first season episodes, at least I was like, this is a lame show about a doofusy, generic American guy stuck in space, right?
Yeah.
And stuff happening to him, and it's not all that compelling.
No.
But then, a second, like, having seen the whole thing, you realize that it's the story of a doofusy, or maybe not doofusy, but like, you know, very wide-eyed, innocent, all-American boy lost in space who will slowly be driven insane and have his humanity stripped away.
Yes.
And it's just a much more interesting story. So going back and watching those kind of mediocre episodes are much more interesting, realizing where he's going to go, and that sort of fall into insanity has greater poignancy only if you see, you know, John Crichton with his like wide innocent eyes running around in his fairly hokey not NASA spacesuit.
See, but it's funny because the stuff that you're talking about rewatching does have a degree of meta plot to it, right? Like
right,
in Babylon 5.
Yeah.
The big thing I was rewatching up until Netflix got rid of it was Next Generation.
Oh yeah.
Like I decided that I was gonna sweep through Next Generation, starting at like season 1, episode 1, Encounter at Farpoint.
You were also committed to that project.
And
there's a lot more crappy episodes than that.
Just and also we're sort of realizing, you know, that watching it in this context of just, okay, I'm going to just watch the next one and just watch the next one, like, you know, kind of binging, is very different from how I grew up with it, which was either A, catching it when it was actually airing for the first time, or catching it in syndication, which is probably how I saw most of it.
Yeah.
Like, I want to say, like, every night at, like, 9 or 10 in Nashville, like, The Next Generation would come on, and, you know, so I'd get, like, during summer, I'd watch, like, one at night, maybe. And I feel like most of those were probably taken from, like, the better seasons, certainly not seasons 1 and 2. Like, I certainly found the gaps in my Star Trek education in seasons, like, in episodes, seasons 1 and 2, like, when the space Nigerians come to take away their white women. Oh, that was rough.
Oh, yeah?
There was some pretty awfulness. Well, and again, the show was sort of finding itself, and it was really, you know, still in the kind of the old Star Trek mode. You know, it felt like the cheesy cardboard sets and really like bright primary colors. And, you know, by the time I was getting into season 3, season 4, they were starting to kind of find what the look of Next Generation was going to be like and how it was distinct. And like, they finally found outfits that didn't make Picard look like a twig.
Yeah.
Riker's beard came in.
Well, I guess on that note, the other thing I've been rewatching is Get Smart.
Oh, yeah, because you just got the DVDs.
Yeah, because they were like 80% off on Amazon, and I'm a sucker.
That is the free hand of the market.
It is. But that is a fascinating project of sort of rediscovering childhood nostalgia.
Okay.
Because while I'm not old enough to have watched Get Smart in the 60s,
no,
I definitely watched it on Nick at Night.
Yeah.
When I was like, I loved it when I was 10, 11, 12 years old.
Uh-huh.
And it was like my favorite show ever. So it's just been fascinating remembering these, like, I don't really remember episodes, but I remember moments.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Do you
remember, like, that they only have 6 jokes?
I was going to say, I remember the 6 jokes that are in every episode.
A childhood TV show that I went back to a while back, because I think we just got the second season of it, and I didn't binge through it, but we found it interesting, was the old Batman animated series.
Oh, okay.
And that was interesting, seeing like, oh, wow, the animation in this was pretty awful. Like, I was pretty forgiving as a kid. And yet, realizing that the audio and the sound for that show was amazing. Like, it's fun kind of finding these little things that, you know, you either glossed over as a kid or, you know, just weren't paying attention to because you weren't really thinking about it at the time. Are you excited by the masterful technical skills of Get Smart? And they're like three like sets that they use. Like every time I see them in like a graveyard, I'm like, yep, there's the same like plastic graveyard that looks like, you know, the one from Beetlejuice.
Yes, and 99's acting range is not
stellar.
It's a lot of, oh, Max!
Well, at least, you know, the sexism in that show is so weird.
Well, it's really weird because she definitely is like doting on him.
Yeah.
Even though he's an idiot, and he definitely gets the credit for everything. She's sort of like the competent woman behind the.
Well, it's the
eccentric man.
The policy and the sort of the scenario that would eventually define Inspector Gadget. You know.
Yeah. But where 99 is replaced by a small girl. Let's look at the sexism of that. But there is a weird fact that, like, there is some degree where she is, like, the one coming on to him romantically in a lot of moments, and he's just sort of innocently oblivious to which I find kind of interesting.
Well, and they make weird sort of sexist jokes, but then they sort of, like, lampshade the sexism in weird ways.
Yeah, very true. So I'm not sure. I need to watch more of it, but I feel like there could be interesting things going on there.
Maybe.
Possibly. I might be giving it too much credit.
So, do you have anything more in the realm of TV, or shall we move to books?
I think we move to books.
I feel like as a kid, I don't know. I remember rereading The Hobbit a bunch. I remember going back to that like a ton as a kid. But I'd have to say, in recent years, the book that I have reread, I want to say now 3 times.
I cannot believe how many times you've read that book.
Is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell?
Like, that's just not a book that you reread.
But it's so fun.
I know.
And it has whimsical footnotes.
I know you love it so much.
Pratchett used to be someone that I could like reread over and over again.
Yeah.
Bouchold, I can get like about 2 or 3 rereads. I think I've now had.
Oh man, I can read A Civil Campaign.
That's true.
I can reread. It depends on which book.
Yeah.
Right?
What mood you're in.
But I can reread A Civil Campaign over and over and over again.
You know, speaking of, this is our 30th episode, so you know, this is like our memory episode.
Yes.
Our podcast has hit 30, but will 30 hit back?
But Cordelia's Honor and Civil Campaign are 2 books that I can just.
That's fair. I could probably go through those guys a whole bunch just because they are so fun.
I think it's clear that I like Cordelia Naismith.
Well, because she's awesome?
Yeah, absolutely.
Does anyone not like Cordelia Naismith?
But again, it's just, I think with those, it's something about returning to the familiar.
Well, that's also just returning to a world that I really like. I have also reread the Game of Thrones books, you know, a decent amount.
I think it's something different. Like, I reread Game of Thrones.
To remember what,
well, you're
for the,
like, what
this book.
In the world actually happened in this book, right? But to sort of get better details and pick up on nuances of character that I missed.
Yeah.
Bujold I reread because it makes me happy. It's like rereading Neil Gaiman.
Yeah.
It's returning to something that's familiar that just.
Well, and with books, I don't know, like, it's sort of like with, you know, returning to TV shows, like, several years later, you catch up on things. I mean, with rereading books, like, I know I did not like American Gods the first time I read it. Or I didn't hate it, but, like, I was disappointed. I read it, like, right after reading, I want to say, like, Stardust and Neverwhere, and I just, like, I had that very British-y cadence.
Yeah,
and then
American Gods is a very American feeling book.
But when I reread it, I really enjoyed it. Like, I think I found, like, okay, no, I saw what I was sort of, and I could see the stuff that I was kind of responding negatively to. But the stuff that really, like, popped and was great, really popped and was really great.
Yeah.
Second time around. I don't think I've gone through that a third time, though.
No.
It's just big. Although then Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is big, and I could reread that over
and
over.
I will say there's also things I do when I reread books, which is like picking a random episode of a TV show, is I will go back and reread parts of books.
Oh, interesting.
Have I never told you that I do that?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I will go back and, like, to my favorite parts of books.
Oh, weird.
And reread just, like, chapters or chunks.
That's
without
very strange.
Reading a whole book.
Okay.
Because I just want to go back to, like, a part that I like.
I don't think I've ever seen that. That's very strange.
So I'll reread the cataclysmic dinner scene in
A
Campaign, right?
Yeah.
Or I'll just go over and read the ending of it.
Yeah.
In the Council of Counts.
Oh, so good.
Like that. Or if I just want to, like, rip my soul out, I'll reread the last, like, 10 pages of Cryoburn.
Now, are you like our friend and past guest Andrew Reeves? And do you read The Silmarillion, like, every year?
I have never finished The Silmarillion.
Yeah, I barely started
this
The Silmarillion.
There was like a 5-year period where I didn't reread The Silmarillion every year, but every year I'd be like, this is the year that I'm going to read The Silmarillion, and I get, like, I don't know, 100 pages in, and, like,
it's just like reading the worst parts of the Old Testament.
But the problem is, I'm a medievalist. I actually know the, like, Norse mythological sort of style that Tolkien is.
So echoing. It just feels like homework.
No, I'm saying I should be able to get through it. I should be able to enjoy it. And I like, I'm the one who will like rant about how if you like the ride of the Rohirrim in the Return of the King can be parsed for Anglo-Saxon cadence.
Whoa.
I mean, like, it's. I enjoy that aspect of Tolkien, and yet I just like,
can't do it. Did you reread much just straight up Tolkien, like Lord of the Rings or Hobbit much?
Yeah.
Because yeah. I only ever been through them once a piece.
Really?
Actually, that's not true. Really? I read Two Towers first. I think my dad and I tried starting with Fellowship, and I got really bored. Like in the early.
Like I remember when I was a kid, part of why I never actually read the Lord of the Rings when I was a little kid was because I just couldn't. I remember reading Fellowship, and I just got defeated by it.
Well, and eighth.
I read it right after The Hobbit. Like I read The Hobbit.
Yeah. Well, same here.
And I was like, this isn't as fun as The Hobbit.
Well, I remember I was in seventh or eighth grade. Like I think it was on the summer reading list, and they had like all three books, like you could pick. And I was like, well, I've already started Fellowship, and I saw the Ralph Bakshi movie, so I'll just read Two Towers. So I read Two Towers, and then senior year, I finally decided I was going to read all of it. And I remember reading. Like blitzing through Fellowship, finally, you know, going through Two Towers, being like, "Oh, that's what this was. I see now. This is why I should care about Treebeard." But I remember finishing Return of the King while in the middle of a play. Like I was like backstage.
Really?
It probably. Oh, let's see. Senior year, it would have either have been Twelfth Night or Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, Twelfth Night. The reason we met.
That's right. The reason we met. I did not reread Shakespeare for fun. I'm sorry.
You're a bad actor.
I'm a traitor to my craft. I will read David Ives plays over and over again because those are amazing.
See, I do not enjoy reading plays.
Yeah.
I mean, Shakespeare is one thing, but like
David Ives, though, is candy. Like David Ives is just ridiculous and fun. So I don't know. It's sort of like reading Stoppard. Like I probably have read like Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, like over and over.
I guess Tom Stoppard is like reading Shakespeare. Well, I mean, I'm
very proud of him. When he's aping Shakespeare.
Yeah, but he's very literary. It's like reading it's like reading Waiting for Godot, right? Like, there are literary
merits.
Plays.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And then there are plays that just need to be staged.
Oh, well, no, that's very true. And I think there's, you know, that's part of the problem of teaching theater, right? Is in the English classes is you're teaching it as just written as opposed to, anyway,
this is a digression.
As a bit of an ersatz drama teacher, I should probably move away from this. But books.
Yes.
Anything else?
Oh, I definitely have reread Lord of the Rings multiple times. And I think it's, again, because the language is so rich and the imagery is so rich, you just like delving into that.
Have you read comic books a bunch? Actually, that's not even true. I tried to go through and do The Sandman again and just got bogged down.
Jane Austen.
Oh, yeah.
I can reread Jane Austen over and over and over again, except for Mansfield Park.
That's what the blankets we're now selling at our store are named after.
What?
The Mansfield Collection.
Really?
Yep. That's why that's our literary connection. That's why we're selling it at a bookstore.
I hate that book so much.
Is that the one with the dumb tutor?
Tutor?
Isn't it like a tutor girl who's dumb and she marries someone and it's all dumb?
It's a Jane Austen book where someone marries someone.
Or is she a governess?
No, she's not a governess. She's like the poor relation.
There's relations.
She's a poor relative who goes to live with her.
Like, is she trying to find a living?
No, she's like living with her cousins. And she is good and noble and virtuous.
Oh,
and
okay.
Her cousins are
so boring.
And she's definitely boring. And her cousins are really boring, except for her cousin Edmund, who's also like noble and virtuous, and she's in love with him.
Oh, incest!
They're both moral together.
Oh, great.
Except that he's in love with like another horrible woman.
Oh, good.
And when she eventually proves that she doesn't prove that she is immoral. His sister runs off with a married man.
Oh, okay.
And because she does not condemn his sister and is just trying to find up a way to cover up the scandal for the family as opposed to being outraged at her licentiousness.
So she's not self-righteous enough.
Yeah, she's not self-righteous enough. Cousin Edmund rejects her and realizes that Fanny is there and has been nice and good and modest for the whole time and decides to settle on
You've been demure and kept your place. I shall marry you.
Yeah, basically.
Yay! Basically.
And it's so long and so boring.
Like Jane Austen.
The Jane Austen books are short and quirky and, I mean, short from like...
Regency.
Regency novel period. But, yeah. Ooh, Henry Fielding.
Oh, yes.
I should reread Tom Jones.
I should reread
Tom
Jones.
I think I've only read that once. But,
that's good times.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Whimsical footnotes.
Whimsical footnotes, absolutely. I remember when I was at Oxford, my 18th century novel tutor got so annoyed with me because I was like, I went to my first meeting with her for my 18th century novel tutorial, and I was like, I want to read Henry Fielding. And she was just like, why would you read Henry Fielding when you can read Samuel Richardson? I was like, why would you read Samuel Richardson when you could read Henry Fielding? And I did not do very well in that class.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, I did not very well by my academic standards.
Yes, I can imagine.
But
who I've been rereading, mostly for professional reasons, has been Lovecraft. And his stuff is sort of short enough that you can kind of like reread and like it blends together after a while. So it's like, is this, wait, have I read this story or is it like just a rehashing of a story he wrote like 10 years earlier? But that's about it as far as sort of books and things that I've gone through. The final.
Jane Eyre. Yes. These are really geeky topics, but they are what I reread.
Okay, no, but that's part of this. You can be a Jane Eyre geek.
I do.
And there's like vicious debates and like fan fights over Jane Eyre. So
really?
Isn't that the one that like your friends like get into weird issues over?
That's the film version. Like that movie has more film versions made of it than anything else I can think of.
Oh, really?
It just, maybe it's because I was looking up the
Michael Fassbender one?
No, I hate that one, actually.
I don't even know what
they
are.
I really didn't like that one. It's the one with Toby Stevens, who plays Orsino in the Twelfth Night movie.
Oh, okay.
Does Rochester in one. I was looking that one up on Amazon, and I just saw how many other... And I've seen most of them.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm like, why is this movie constantly being re... It's like every other year someone comes out with a new version.
It's very salacious.
It is very salacious, and it's very... In rereading it, you realize that it is, like, the proto-feminist novel. Like, no, Jane Eyre is a wonderfully self-realized character for a Victorian heroine.
I'll take it.
And she is the agent of the novel. Dracula is... Sorry, this is turning into, like, another one of my feminist rants, but Dracula is an amazing feminist
novel. Them lady chains.
That's
right. When you were reading Dracula, you kept going on about how, like, Harker is, like, this competent woman being sort of, like, overshadowed, but, like, still being competent.
She's fantastic, and her husband is a total doofus.
Well, that's why they got Keanu Reeves to play him.
Yeah, I know, seriously. But, like, the book isn't, like, excusing the fact that he's a total doofus. He just is a total doofus, and she's amazing, and Van Helsing is just, like, going on all the time about how amazing she is. So, I mean, it's pretty great.
Okay.
Anyway, sorry.
The final category I wanted to look at, because it's a little quirky and a little stranger, but like I feel maybe even more relevant to the sort of the repeat viewing, is bizarre internet phenomena.
Ooh.
Like web series.
Okay.
Like for me, I watch so many of those Strong Bad emails over and over and over again.
Yeah, and you were like sticking with Strong Bad way after everyone else.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Even after they stopped like putting stuff out every week, I would still go every week just to see if they had stuff, and like, oh, you know what, I'll just listen to an answering machine, or oh, I'll listen to an old holiday cartoon or a music video for They Might Be Giants. They were amazing. But there's that weird like checking in thing. But the other part of it is so much of it's very disposable. Like I was thinking, I've listened to so many podcasts, but how many podcasts have I listened to twice?
That's true.
And two came to mind.
Can I guess?
Yes.
The Geeks on Episode 3 play?
The one where they're making fun of the Star Wars?
Yeah.
No, but that's close.
Oh, okay.
The Geeks on episode where their wives and girlfriends took over.
Oh, yeah.
A, I was trying to show that to a lot of folks.
Geeks on was like the first podcast, or one of the first podcasts.
Yeah, it was the second podcast I got into.
Yeah, definitely the first podcast I got into back in like 2004.
Yeah, it would have been around. It was when I was in grad school. So 2005. I think, yeah, 2005.
And it was just like these four guys in like Hollywood
who
were sort of relatively connected to the entertainment industry.
Yeah, there was sort of like, there was like a writer and like a filmmaker and like a video game.
And Christina Hendricks' brother.
Christina Hendricks' brother, which is hilarious because it was like, you know, during the height of like Firefly nerddom. So they just kept talking about like how hot
and
his sister was.
An actor who had actually been in, like, he'd been in episodes of Friends and stuff like that. Yeah.
And so they were talking, you know, they were talking about Dungeons and Dragons and video games and movies and things. But it was interesting because they all had this kind of like LA connection to things. It wasn't just sort of four geeks in a basement. I mean, there was that element to it as well.
Yeah.
And it was also early enough on in our listening to podcasts that we didn't quite realize that all podcasts, including this one, are just like a handful of geeks sitting around making references.
Yeah.
Although now we have a third geek to make references with us, although her references are mostly poop-based. but they had this great episode years in, where they had their wives and girlfriends podcast and talk about being the wife or girlfriend to a geek. But they also had one girl there, because one of them wasn't married or dating anyone. So they had one of
Lisa Lassick. The editor of like Joss Whedon's go-to. She edited the Avengers.
Yeah.
I hadn't realized that.
But they had her on just to be like an actual geek as opposed to just like dating a geek. And it was so fascinating. And it was this really interesting kind of look into...
No, I want to go back and re-listen to it again.
That was something I really appreciated and I really found fascinating. But the other thing, and the only other podcast I've gone back and re-listened to, I think maybe a few My Brother and Me's, but not really a whole lot. But there was a strange podcast that I listened to that really, I don't know if I had any business listening to it. It was called Webcomics Weekly, and it was four web cartoonists, Scott Kurtz, Christopher Straub, Dave Kellett, and Brad Geiger. Dave Kellett, you know, from Sheldon. And I read a few.
He drew me a picture of a pug.
Yes, he did. And I'd read a few of their webcomics, but I didn't read all of them. But their podcast was just them talking about what it takes to be a cartoonist and, like, you know, being a self-employed person on the internet, and then just them making lots of pop culture references. And then a little while back, I think I just had run out. My pace of listening to podcasts had outpaced the actual number of podcasts I was downloading. So I went back and started re-listening to old episodes of Webcomics Weekly, and I found they really spoke to me, especially as I was getting started doing my Ask Lovecraft stuff, because it was all about like creating content on the internet and what to expect from it, and not to like go into it with this idea that, okay, I'm going to do this, and then 6 weeks later I'm going to start like selling t-shirts and like things like that. And this is, I've been thinking of this because just recently someone made a t-shirt for Ask Lovecraft, and that's now like selling, and that's kind of crazy that they're selling out there with my face on it. That, you know, I have no idea if I'll see any money from it. I doubt it. But I like the fact that it's out there, and it's over a year later. And, you know, I don't make any money off Lovecraft, and that's precisely what they talked about. They talked about the fact that, you know, as web cartoonists, they went, you know, 5-10 years just doing it out of the love, and then slowly but surely it, you know, began to turn into a career. But it's, you know, there's so much kind of content being made online. And, you know, I mean, this is an example of something that's just we're creating. We're putting it out there largely for our friends, maybe a few strangers, you know.
Because one night, like a year ago, we were sitting around going, hey, let's make a podcast.
And if you are not one of our friends, and even if you are, maybe leave a few comments so we can know you better. And you can become our friends, at least through the magic of podcastery. That was just a podcast that I really found compelling listening to, even... You know, and that was like 3 or 4 years old, you know, when I went back to re-listen to them. But that's pretty much the exception. Like, I mean, with podcasts, because they're every week, so...
Well, I just think there's so much content, it's hard to go back and...
No, that's very true. But like,
there are certain things, like there are Vlogbrother episodes that I've gone and, and rewatched.
Well, did you rewatch the Lizzie Bennett stuff, or have you just kind of gone... Okay.
Have you met me?
Well, I know you had watched it. I was just wasn't sure.
But no, absolutely. Because you pick up on new jokes.
Oh, yeah.
It's fun.
Well, and again, because the format's so much shorter than
I think part of it for me as well, being such an academically oriented person.
Oh, yes.
There is an analytical part of my, especially academically oriented in the humanities, right?
Yes.
In literary stuff. And having taken various film classes and
like
stuff.
Like you do.
There is a part of me that loves to go back and analyze things.
Oh, I see.
Over and over and over again, right? So the rewatching things is part of that. I want to pick up new things. I want to I want to rip everything apart. I want to, you know, break it down into pieces and get all the nuance and stuff. Not quite as creepy as the people with The Shining, but a similar principle.
Indeed. And to finally bring this all into, you know, the faith part of this, how does this all, this kind of repetitive viewing and, like, approach go to how we approach Scripture?
Oh, see, I wasn't even going to go with Scripture. I'm such an Anglican. We love the Bible. I was just going to go with the liturgical year.
Go on.
It's the life of Christ. It's rooted in Scripture.
Go on. I didn't say anything.
But I was thinking with the season of Advent, yeah, right? We're starting
New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year. We're re-entering the cycle of the church's year that we go through every single year, yeah, right? And we do encounter the same scripture readings over and over and over again.
Yeah.
In this, it's a 3-year cycle. And, you know, the fourth Sunday of Advent, we will be reading Mary's encounter with the angel. The Sunday after Easter, every year, we will be reading the story of Doubting Thomas and Jesus appearing to the disciples.
Mm-hmm.
There is a huge repetition to the way in which we live out and re-experience the life of Christ through the yearly cycle of readings. And there is a repetition to that and a repetitiveness that the liturgy brings us, which is why some, you know, Christians I know who are not inclined towards the liturgy find it boring, find it repetitive, find it stale,
yeah,
in that, or rote in that way. But I mean, there is that, I mean, for one thing, there's the kind of idea of being caught up in the timelessness of God's time as opposed to human time, right?
Yeah.
So the idea that there is something eternal about the liturgy, but also just this idea of we do return to these stories over and over and over again. We are challenged to find something new in them. We are challenged to let God speak to us through them.
Well, and do you see that same interplay between, like, actively seeking new information or new points of view and just sort of passively absorbing, you know, in that same way that we, you know, as you watch something or you read something, you're sort of looking for new things as opposed to just letting the familiar kind of wash over you?
Well, I think, yeah. Well, part of it is the difference between my role as a priest and someone's role as a member of the congregation, right?
Yeah.
One is definitely more active in a way than the other. Like, the challenge of preaching the same texts year after year.
Yeah.
And finding something new.
That's why you have kids, so that you can come up with new anecdotes.
I'm terrible at sermon illustrations.
Yeah. You didn't play enough football.
It's true. But it's something, when I was ordained and started preaching on a regular basis, it was definitely something that in some ways it made the liturgy much richer to me.
Sure.
That actually, you know, you realize how much we are enacting this story every year, and you see the way, you know, you see the way Lent progresses from the temptation of Christ in the wilderness to on the first Sunday of Lent every year to the, you know, story of the Passion and the crucifixion and entering Lent the Sunday before Lent with the celebration of the Transfiguration, which is the point when Jesus makes clear to his disciples that being the Messiah will involve suffering and death. So it is appropriate for us to read the story of the Transfiguration before we go into the season of Lent. I'm really rambling here.
That's okay. I think what we're looking at is a similar, like, brain process happening,
yeah,
right?
But from the standpoint of, even when I was, you know, in the congregation as someone who was very engaged in,
yeah,
my faith and going to seminary and all of that, the cycle of the liturgy was something that I experienced in a much more passive way, just kind of letting it wash over you and experiencing it, but maybe not, like, tearing it apart.
Yeah.
And I think my role as a priest is to try to make that accessible.
Okay.
To the congregation.
I think that's fair.
Even if it doesn't always get absorbed, or just absorbed very, very passively and sort of subconsciously, if not consciously by everyone?
Well, it's, you know, I mean, there is something to sort of biblical literacy, right? And like just, and having people be familiar with things, yeah, and there being a, you know, a strength that, I mean, with the Baptists, it's drilled, yeah, you know, sort of from day one, which is very different from kind of folks, you know, see here who seem to come to it more casually.
Well, it's cool. We actually, over the last year and a half, I had a group of people in the parish that we were actually reading through the whole Bible.
Oh, together. Right. And for some folks, it was like their kind of their first time really, yeah, like...
Well, putting the story together.
Yeah.
And it was just really... Like, it's really cool to see people make those connections and realize that, oh wait, the Bible does actually tell a coherent story and these pieces do all come together. And it's really cool. I mean, I remember when I, in seminary... really began to see connections that I had never seen before and realized that these stories that I knew in disjointed ways actually really did connect and have context and create a coherent narrative.
And then there comes all the sort of patient explanations during Joshua.
Yes, maybe we'll not go down that road right now.
Slide on past that. But I think that, yeah, I think that that shows, you know, what the joy of going back to the old and the familiar, you know, in our media, and, you know, in our books, in our shows, you know, I mean, we are creatures of habit, right? And we like, you know, seeing what's familiar, but finding something kind of new each time with it.
What is your favorite Bible story?
My favorite Bible story? Jesus?
I was thinking about when I was a kid, my favorite Bible stories were the story of Naaman and the young slave
girl. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Healing, or explaining to Naaman how to get healed. And the story of Doubting Thomas, because, or maybe it wasn't the story, it's one of the stories where Jesus appears to the disciples and they're eating fish, and I really liked it because I liked eating fish sticks. And I imagine Jesus and the disciples eating fish sticks.
See, I just had my really gory picture Bible, so like I loved all the Old Testament politics stuff. Like I loved the, you know, the story of like David and like
really
hiding
Old Testament,
like, hiding from Saul and like all the generals and the betrayals, and like just that was the stuff that got me really excited, you know. But and then, you know, either you get to New Testament, it's like, oh right, Jesus. I suppose this is nice. Up until the end. Well, I guess up until the penultimate end. And then the end is happy. And then the book of Revelation just sort of confused me.
You know what? My least favorite book of the Bible is probably the book of Acts. I'm just thinking about the fact that, like...
It's because of all the communism.
No. But I'm thinking about, like, the Daily Office. And there's a point every summer... Or I forget whether it's year one or year two in the 2-year cycle of the readings for morning and evening prayer. And at one point it hits Acts, and it's like half a chapter of Acts every morning.
Oh, I see.
For like weeks on end.
There's a lot of
Acts.
I'm
like, can we get back to Paul? I like Paul's letters. Acts just gets
a little heavy.
Yeah.
Sort of keeps going.
Well, just it gets long.
Well, he was a doctor.
Yeah. I like the Bible, really, I do.
Oh, you backslider.
We had, one day when we were in seminary, a bunch of us were hanging out in the lobby and professors were walking by and we were polling them on what book of the Bible they would remove if they answered.
Yes. Who was the most on danger of the chopping block for this this rather...
I remember our New Testament...
Problematic council.
The New Testament professor who taught the, like... We had the Gospels course and then the non-Gospels course. She was going to chop out Revelation.
Well, you know.
Because, you know.
It does confuse the waters a little.
One professor would have taken out Hebrews, which just made me really sad.
Well, that is sad. Hebrews is so sweet.
I know. Anyway... We're really rambling now.
Hey.
Maybe it's because, like, the baby and the dog are both quiet.
It's like, we can talk. And you can talk to an adult.
I know.
An adult human.
An adult ether.
That's right. All you people out in the world who come to us for our soothing voices as we give the most amazing parenting advice. Apparently the trick to good parenting advice is to ramble on a podcast, because that sort of zonked Amanda out nice and solidly.
After she decides, well, we won't go down
there. Now, we're going to be taking you guys out with Debs and Errol's song from their first album. But do know that their second album, Control-Alt-Duets, is out and is awesome and is full of amazing parody songs. So you should definitely be checking that out. Right now, it's Errol is on a tear to be voted the number one Studio Ghibli fan because the TIFF Bell Lightbox is doing some big Studio Ghibli. That's the Totoro and Howl's Magic Castle and all that sort of stuff. That's been fun to follow on Twitter. But no, this is from their first album, and it's a very strange song. And I think I only picked it because I don't think we've played it before.
Is this Totoro?
No, we have played that one before. This is going to be Let's Vomit exclusively.
All right.
I think having a child has me very aware of bodily fluids.
Realizing that having a child is not a question of whether you will be covered in bodily fluids, but just what kind of bodily fluids.
And from the world of faith, family, fandom, and fluids in no particular order. Geek out, y'all.
It's time for lunch. The sun is shining and the birds are singing. I'm happy.
Hey, Sally.
Yes, Daryl.
I was wondering, well, you see, if you do me the honor of going out with me.
Oh, no.
There's a movie I'm really into with ponies and dinos and beer. They make shakes out of maggots. It killed Keanu's career.
That's why I like it.
And then we can go steady and super glue our hands and stay forever and always and ever like a whaler and her man.
Your odor pokes intrusively. I don't dare act elusively. I can only spew the truth. I say this with impunity. I'd rather puke exclusively than spend exclusive time with you. Let's go for a stroll and vomit exclusively.
The call of the walrus.
Pick a bush and vomit unyieldingly.
Aw, you're good at that.
Guess what I had for dinner last night?
An egg and turkey sandwich.
That's right.
Oh, Sally.
Yes, Daryl.
Your pavement pizza is divine. Would you do me the honor? Oh, Sally, please be mine.
Oh, dear.
We could move into a house, impregnate you right away, and then spin around in circles and stick on appliques. And then we could get married and cement ourselves at the hip.
I mean, Daryl.
For always and ever and always. That's what I call courtship.
I'd like to speak diffusively about this opportunity that you've so persuasively raised. I detest your jejunity. I'd rather chuck effusively than come and share your personal space. Ew! Let's go for a stroll and vomit exclusively. Oh God, stop chasing me! Pick a bush and vomit unyieldingly.
Pickled beans and salad.
That's right.
Pickled beans and salad. Pickled beans and salad. Pickled beans and salad.
That's right. I let you touch me. Now please get away.